Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A reminder, we Zoom on Sunday afternoon, so if he pulls a rabbit out of his hat on Sunday night, we'll be discussing it on Tuesday. We begin every show, as we have for months, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I remember as I was listening to him thinking, oh my God, maybe I should have joined the State Department. What a fool. And then I realized, he was a patriot. He understood talking truth to power. And when he assured his papa it would be all right, in my stomach and in my head, I knew it would not. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So if it's Monday, it's our Rethink the Week, and we always bring together an interesting panel of guests to schmooze about the chaos of the last 6 or 7 days. Joining me right now, as he always does, is Dean Spiliotis. He is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He also has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com, and is a regular on New Hampshire Public Radio. Welcome back, Dean.
Hi, Ernie. Good to be with you.
And an old friend, I have known him for decades. Rick Newman is a state legislator, but he's no longer a state legislator. And now he has sort of morphed into a lobbyist. He lobbies for a lot of the organizations I used to fight. But I love Rick because I love his mind and he's always coming up with creative thoughts. So let me welcome Rick Newman to the program. How are you, Rick?
I'm well. Nice to be here.
And just recently, within the last year or two, I got to meet Stephen Pimper. He is a professor at UNH Manchester. He is a senior fellow at the Carsey Institute. He is an expert on issues of poverty. And unfortunately, his level of expertise is more and more in demand with each passing day. So with that, let me welcome Stephen Pimper to the program. How are you, Stephen?
Hi, Arnie. Good to be here as well.
So just this afternoon, I happened to have MSNBC on, and I heard that Anthony Scaramucci was coming on. And of course, Anthony Scaramucci worked for the Trump administration for what was it, 11 days, I think. He had a long stint with Donald Trump. But he said something that I immediately wrote down. I turned it into a Facebook post and I turned it into a tweet. And here's what Anthony Scaramucci said. In three words, he nailed Donald Trump. He has made us weaker, sicker, poorer. And I'm like, that's it. And the only folks that aren't weaker, sicker, or poorer are the very affluent, because we know that billionaires have seen their billions increase by about 30% since the beginning of this pandemic, which is kind of shocking. It's even created new billionaires. So they figured out how to sort of use the pandemic as a wealth-growing opportunity. But for virtually everybody else, it hasn't been that way. So I'm going to start with the poorer piece. And what does that mean? I need to turn to Stephen Pimper. So Stephen, there was already an enormous gap between rich and poor. We already knew that before the pandemic. All the pandemic did was sort of exasperate something that we have seen over the last couple of decades, and in the last couple of years, becoming more and more, I think, grotesque. But what is so shocking about the poorer now is that in a lot of ways, it's also intentionally poor, because while Donald Trump agreed to some kind of a bailout, you know, a couple of months ago, he has refused to embrace anything as this pandemic continues, as more people are permanently losing their jobs or unable to go back to work or working part-time jobs now or are significantly underemployed. And I think the level of poverty and the intensity of the poverty given this pandemic is something that many people can't even quite comprehend, but too many people in America are living.
So I want to complicate the story a little bit, I think, and that is just to point out a couple of things. One is that if you look at official Census Bureau poverty measures, and there are loads of problems with those, but if we look at just those for the moment, we reached our lowest level of nationwide poverty in 1973. At 11.1%. And since then, and it sort of crept up, escalated a bit in the 80s. And since about the 1990s, we have consistently had national official poverty rates around 12, 13%. And that's been pretty steady, blip up and down every now and again here or there. But that is, in fact, a story across Republican and Democratic administrations and Congresses alike, right? We historically have done a worse job caring for the least among us than have other rich democracies. And if I can, let me just sort of point out one way to think about why that is. There's a way of thinking about poverty. We can think about pre-transfer and post-transfer poverty rates, right? And pre-transfer is basically saying how much poverty does the economy itself create before we count the stuff that government does to alter that, right? So if you look at sort of OECD nations, right, rich democracies around the world, the United States isn't actually an outlier when you look at pre-transfer poverty rates. We have comparable levels of poverty to all kinds of other European nations. We actually have lower levels of pre-transfer poverty rates even than places like Sweden, right? However, when you then count in the things that government does that mitigates the raw effects of the market, that's when we become the outlier, right? We have radically more poverty than any other of those rich nations for a simple reason, right? We do less to reduce it. Let me say one more thing before I surrender, and that is, if you look at the first recovery and relief bills, right, and especially look at the cash grants, but even more important, the emergency 600 supplemental unemployment benefit, right? There are former colleagues of mine at Columbia University who have sort of built their own poverty measure based on some of what the census does. We actually saw poverty decline in the second quarter of 2020 because suddenly, we became a government that does what we know is the most effective and efficient thing that you can do to reduce poverty, which is give people money. It is at some level no more complicated than that, and it took a global pandemic and fear of a collapsing economy for us to learn that lesson. And we've, of course, now unlearned it by letting those benefits expire. And we will then see the predictable results of that in widespread immiseration and suffering.
And Rick, one of the things I always thought was interesting, and I think maybe you're the one that actually taught this to me, but the question is, where did they come up with the 600? Like, why 600? Why not 500? Why 400? Where did that number come from? And I think, Rick, you mentioned to me that if you actually took $15 an hour times 40 hours a week, you would get $600. So in a lot of ways, that's fascinating. And of course, we're talking about people that are unemployed. And people keep saying, oh, but they're getting an unemployment check. I think $600 makes them grotesquely rich. And I'm thinking, really, have you seen the size of an unemployment check? You know, for most people, an unemployment check might be $100 a week. You know, I mean, it's a joke in many, many states in the United States. And if you factor in that if suddenly you are unemployed, Rick, and you might be losing your benefits, oh, the good news is you could go on COBRA, but COBRA might cost you two of those $600 checks just in the first month. So again, a lot of people don't even understand what it means to be unemployed, because unless you've lived it, unless you've had to buy COBRA, you know, it's a storyline for someone else, and $600 sounds like they're swimming in cash. And in reality, they're not, Rick.
Yeah, in the best of states that do unemployment, the unemployment max is very low. In some states like Florida, the unemployment system is terrible. I mean, I've actually heard from many people in Florida who to this day have yet to receive an unemployment check going back months ago from March and shutdown. Their infrastructure is so antiquated, they couldn't handle the influx of applicants, and the and in some cases, people have told me they feel like the office has given up because they don't even answer the phone anymore. So, yeah, the $600, I know I've heard a lot of business people grumble. It kept people from going back to work because they were making more money at home than they were going back to work for $8 an hour. I don't really think that was very widespread, but I just think there is a big misconception. This thing, I think, has opened our eyes to a number of things in this country that people didn't realize. And I think one of them is folks who are working in these jobs that we depend on, that we didn't realize how much we depended on them until this pandemic hit. The grocery store clerk, the gas station attendant, you know, the nurse, the person at the walk-in center that takes down all your information. These people became very important to all of us, and they always were, but I think we noticed it more. And if anything good came out of it, maybe it was that.
Actually, let me sort of build on that comment, because they said, Dean, more people are more aware of this election and are more engaged with this election than they think ever has happened in history. That doesn't mean more people will vote, but they are so conscious of an election like they have never been conscious before. And I think they're also beginning to connect the dots that elections have consequences. Another thing, for my Democratic friends, the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been the best teaching tool that the court matters. You know, conservatives and evangelicals have known that for decades. I mean, that was Ralph Reed's mantra back in the early 1990s, was the court. You know, and I mean, and in a way he taught me, but he just didn't teach the rest of my Democratic friends. So I do think that what Rick is saying is we are now getting a new awareness of who we depend on. We're getting a new awareness of how poor people are. We're learning what it is to live on an unemployment check. A lot of these jobs might never return. So in a bizarre way, the pandemic and the ineffectiveness of Donald Trump to respond to the pandemic has been a useful teaching tool, even as it's cratered a significant portion of the economy and it's put people in so much peril because of the illness, Dean.
Yeah, it's really been a study and an experience in extremes. Extreme, yes. Economic dislocation, extreme pandemic dislocation. We haven't seen either before. There's certainly a pandemic in over 100 years, and economically, this is pretty much as bad as it's ever been. I mean, there really is something for everyone in terms of becoming more aware and more mobilized than perhaps you've been in the past. You know, we always say to some extent, this is the most important election in our lifetime, and elections have consequences. But we're seeing a series of extremes that have just not been around to test our society in decades and decades, certainly in the case of the pandemic, over 100 years. And I think a lot of the kind of inequities that everyone is describing, and economic dislocation, all of that is a new experience, I think, for people. It's laid bare a number of structural problems that maybe we've been able to kind of obscure or paper over in the past. And social media combined with President Trump's use of social media as a tool, all of these things have really kind of, so it's this amazing confluence of these, you know, historic dislocations combined with a political environment that would be toxic even without them.
Exactly. So I'm going to recommend an article to all of you. I think I linked it to it, but I really want everyone to read it. Bloomberg Businessweek just came out with an article. I think it landed in people's mail just yesterday. Harvard's Chetty finds economic carnage in the wealthiest zip codes. I'm going, the wealthiest zip codes? What is this about? And let me just read you a couple of sentences. Last month, a couple of days after former Vice President Joe Biden selected California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate, Chetty briefed the pair over a video presenting data that demonstrated lower income workers were bearing the brunt of the COVID recession. His chart showed that by April, the bottom quarter of wage earners, those making less than $27,000 a year, had lost almost 11 million jobs, more than three times the number lost by the top quarter, which earned more than $60,000 annually. By late June, the gap had widened further, even though more businesses had reopened. In fact, the segment of Americans who are paid best had recovered almost all the jobs lost since the start of the pandemic. The recession has essentially ended for high-income individuals, Chetty told Biden and Harris. Meanwhile, the bottom half of American workers, representing almost 80% of the jobs, are either still missing or missing income. So he goes on and on and on to talk about this. Now, this is the part I tweeted about and I Facebooked. But you got to feel bad for the rich. Can I tell you why? And here's why you got to feel bad. So we know the billionaires, so their billions increased by 30%. We know that the more affluent probably have their jobs back. They're able to work from home. They can Zoom. They're saving money on gas, yada, yada, yada. Yeah, the kids are home, but they each have their own computer and they probably have a nanny helping them with their school. Here's the kicker. With all that money that they have no quality of life. There's no theater. There's no opera. There's no place to show up those chimichus. There's no place to really go out and socialize. That they're cocooned in their home. They can't go on vacation. There isn't a cruise. They don't have a life. And I looked at him describing what has happened to the wealthy. And all I kept smiling about in a funny way is, let me introduce you to the King Midas fable 2020. Everything they touch is gold. They're roaring back. They may be richer because of Wall Street, but what the frick is the money for if you don't even have something that looks like a life? And that's where the story of this pandemic being the economy is even true for them. They have money, but guess what? What's the money for, Stephen? So you see the sacrifice of the poor. You see what's happening to the underemployed. You see the frustration of frontline workers who are at risk of getting the pandemic. And then you see the very affluent, and all they can do is clip coupons and take a look at Wall Street and see how their portfolio has grown. But I don't know about you, but that's not how I want to live a life.
I've long thought that if we could not convince people to care about the well-being of other humans for empathetic reasons, then perhaps maybe we can get them to do it for selfish reasons, right? And this is one of the ways in which this plays out. You can see it in New York before the pandemic, right? Because sort of the concentration of wealth has gone off the charts in that city, right? All of the things that made me move there in 1983, they're gone. Right, the sort of things that make a city vibrant and attractive to this enormously diverse array of people from around the world, that sort of concatenation of all kinds of people with all kinds of interests and skills and talents that really do make cosmopolitan places, have been eroded over the decades. And there are places, as I was leaving New York, one of the things that gave me this horrible little satisfaction is that there are regions, particularly like Soho, that have been occupied by you know, Hollywood celebrities and other kinds of millionaires and billionaires, that have driven the real estate prices in those neighborhoods so high that all of the clever little shops and the adorable fashionable restaurants have closed because they were no longer able to pay their rent. So you are starting to see these emergence of neighborhoods with large numbers of rich people living there and absolutely none of the amenities that brought them there in the first place, right? The other way we see this play out, right, sort of our mutual interdependence, is the pandemic itself, right? I mean, it's become a cliche now, but if we are going to say, well, you know what, the people who are most disproportionately affected are poor Black and brown people, and that's not me, so, oh, well, the hell with them, let them die. Right? I mean, that's awful and callous in a thousand ways. It is also stupid because it is a pandemic and it will not stop at East 96th Street, right? And stop from going into your neighborhood on Park Avenue in the 80s, right? That what happens to the least of us will ultimately happen to all of us if we don't build a more protective society.
And Rick, as I'm listening to Stephen, I remember when I was talking to someone who cares for older people. She's a nurse's aide, okay? And she's on the clock, okay? And so she goes in and she has to bathe them and feed them and change them and do all those things. And she looked at me at one point and she said, how do I bathe a 90-year-old faster, okay? How do I feed someone who's drooling faster to make sure they still get the nutrition? So they expect me to perform, but what they realize I am doing is I am literally her arms, her legs, I'm doing all this stuff. And the problem now becomes, these are the people that are so susceptible to getting COVID-19. These are the people that you need in your nursing homes, you need in your homes, you need to care for your kids, you need to be in the schools. So even if the rich are so protected, Rick, they're not, because they need someone to care for their mother, and they need someone to care for their kid. They need someone to mow their lawn, and they need someone to clean their house, because the last time they cleaned the house was when they were 10, you know? And I, again, the pandemic, not only is it the economy, but the pandemic is describing what kind of a quilt we have called a society that we somehow have forgotten to sort of make the connection to, Rick.
Well, we absolutely right. I was talking with someone about this just recently, that the things that we all value, we've forgotten to pay for. That's just like, okay, it's December in New England and you go to the grocery store and get a cucumber and you pay 50 cents for it. You know, somebody had to grow it. Somebody has to pack it. Somebody had to ship it. It has to be stored correctly. I mean, someone had to put it out on the produce section. And if it costs 70 cents, you'd bitch about it. We've forgotten that we're like a bunch of spoiled kids, really, that we think we're entitled. All of us think we're entitled to that $1.99 loaf of bread. We've forgotten the people who make the bread, and they have a tough time. So this has raised that awareness. There's no doubt about that. But unfortunately, what my concern is, I don't think it's raised awareness with politicians. They have abandoned the American people. Both sides have just, because all they care about is raising money. When I hear about $100 million, $200 million Senate races are now becoming the norm, and they're spending these obscene amounts of money, the day after they get elected, they start raising money again. They never do their damn job. And that is what is really the problem.
Well, I'm going to say something here, Dean, because I think that's true. And again, I'm going to also say that I think the pandemic, I think climate change, I think Donald Trump, I think Black Lives Matter, I think what happened with Breonna Taylor, which we have to talk about at the second half of the show, because I'm still out of my mind about that. If that isn't a wake-up call, at least for the Democratic Party, that knuckle-dramming, mañana, this sort of like milquetoast compromise makes any sense. I mean, there was an article that just came out that suggested, I think it was in the New Yorker, and the article said, or New York Magazine, and the article said that the Amy Coney Barrett Supreme Court hearings should be nothing more than an anti-GOP infomercial. And the reason it should be, and don't even get into who she is, but they should use this as an opportunity to explain that because of COVID-19, millions of people are now going to have a pre-existing condition. And the woman who's sitting here will probably be asked to overturn the Affordable Care Act and pre-existing conditions. And, you know, that's fine. She can be on the bench, but understand what the Republicans are doing to you. So use this as an opportunity to say, even if you think you don't have a pre-existing condition, even if you don't have diabetes now, even if you haven't had a heart attack or you haven't had cancer, you might have it now, because COVID-19, as Rick was saying, is like everywhere. And this is what the Affordable Care Act is about. Welcome to the world of a pre-existing condition. And that's what this nomination is about. And this is what the Republicans want to do. Use it as an infomercial. Don't even focus on the Supreme Court nomination, but make people understand about the consequences.
You know, we are hearing that suggested by a number of Democratic strategists. I think the concern is that Republicans would like for Democratic senators to go after Judge Barrett, you know, personally, or focus on her Catholicism, or any of those sorts of individual characteristics. And then others are saying, as you are saying, just keep talking about COVID, keep talking about Obamacare, talk about the policy implications of conservative court. And it's interesting, you know, for many years, conservatives pretty effectively painted liberals and liberal justices as supposedly legislating from the bench, you know, basically arguing that because Democrats are having trouble getting anything through Congress, they're using politics by other means, getting liberal justices to essentially do their work for them. More recently, I think Democrats have started to understand they can make the same sort of argument, that there are ways that conservatives can read a negation of rights into the Constitution that is just really legislating by another name as well. So I think you're going to see a tremendous amount of pressure on the Democratic senators to just keep talking about Obamacare, repealing it, pre-existing conditions, other COVID-19, other kinds of policy considerations, immigration, et cetera. She has a pretty significant track record for them to delve into without giving what Republicans hope would be fuel to conservatives to be outraged and claim, you know, anti-Catholic bias or anything like that.
And can I jump on that? Yes, Rick.
Well, what you said, make it an infomercial. That's exactly what they need to do. People don't know what the Affordable Care Act is. You know, only about 10 million people get their health care directly from the Affordable Care Act. But 59 million people get it from Medicaid and 100 million people get it from employers. But there are things in the ACA that all of those people benefit from. Like your 26-year-old can get insurance and the pre-existing condition. And when you say, you know, there are people who say, well, I don't have a pre-existing condition. You don't know if you have a pre-existing condition until you go and get diagnosed. They should take the opportunity to educate the American people. Every senator should focus on that type of questioning.
And the beauty of this is, and Ken, I think you know this, and that is all these cases are in the pipeline. They're coming up literally within hours practically of the election. So it's not like you're saying, well, if. You can actually point to the date. You can point to the case, whether it's about abortion, whether it's about the Affordable Care Act. All these things are right there. They're ready to be taken up. So we're not talking about months from now. We're going to be talking about weeks from now. And that, I think, is another excuse for the infomercial, because you've got the hot little case in your hand and you're saying, this is the date they're going to start looking at it. Am I right, Ken?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that calling it an infomercial really does yourself a disservice, Arnie, because it really is very relevant to her confirmation process. These things really are issues, and they really are important issues. And Trump's and McConnell's rush to judgment to get her on the court and have the votes rounded up before Trump even told us who he was nominating. He wants to overturn Roe. He wants to overturn the ACA. You voters are really going to be affected by this in the very, very near future. And think about it. You know, they have the power to ram this through, and they're probably going to do it. But by God, you are the voters, and you should make them pay. Hold them accountable.
We need to go to a break. When we come back, I want to talk about something I just saw at Vice, and I also saw at thehill.com. It's a t-shirt, and the t-shirt has the notorious ACB, the face of Amy Coney Barrett with a crown on her head. We'll be right back. This is Rethink the Week, The Attitude with Arnie Ornison and producer Ken Barnes, and of course our great panel of guests, Rick Newman, Dean Spiliotis, and Stephen Pimper. We'll be right back.
Religious organizations exist to foster the interests persons subscribing to the same religious faith. Not so for-profit corporations. Workers who sustain these operations are not drawn from one religious community. It bears note that the cost of an IUD is nearly equivalent to a month's full-time pay for workers making minimum wage. Oh, the court, I fear, has ventured into a minefield full of slut-shaming geezers and religious extremism. Oh, one thing's clear, this fight isn't over. We gotta stand together for what we know is right. Any decision to use contraceptives is not propelled by the government. It's the woman's autonomous choice informed by her doctor. Approving some religious claims while deeming others unworthy could be perceived as favoring one religion over another. Would the exemption extend to blood transfusions, antidepressants, and anesthesia, pills coated with gelatin, and vaccinations? Whoa, now the court, I fear, has ventured into a minefield full of slut-shaming geezers and religious. religious extremism. Oh, but one thing's clear, the fight isn't over. We gotta stand together for what we know is right.
All right, round two, you guys. Rethink the Week, par deux. Joining us right now on The Attitude is Stephen Pimpare from UNH Manchester and the Carsey Institute, Dean Sviliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, and Rick Newman, a lobbyist and a former state legislator and someone who I've known for decades and is incredibly interesting and thoughtful. But I've got to go to the notorious ACB. I went to The Hill and it says, GOP online donor platform offering supporters notorious ACB shirt. And of course, this is a knockoff off of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And if you go to slate.com, Dahlia Lithwick, who is just phenomenal, wrote an amazing piece about what they're trying to do, which is somehow create this illusion that she is not only stepping into the seat of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but that she will somehow do for women what Ruth did for women. And this is a continuation of this. And Stephen, it is in fact the opposite of everything Ruth did. As Ruth opened doors, I feel like that Amy Coney Barrett has got the cement and she's about to seal them shut with cement. And yet look what they're doing. They're playing on the emotion of RBG to the point where they're actually using the concepts that surround her as part of their marketing tools.
So if I can, I've got a quick word about that, but I want to go back to our previous conversation about the infomercial, because I want to add one thing into the mix there, because I think this is also an opportunity to talk about the fundamentally undemocratic features of the entire U.S. political system and the way in which it is currently operating. Right, for example, Kavanaugh. Right, the most recent justice confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Senators representing 56% of the U.S. population voted against his confirmation. Right, that is just fundamentally undemocratic. That's how the system works, I get that. But that is fundamentally undemocratic in ways in which we think about majority rule systems. This, if Barrett is confirmed, she will be the third seat of nine, a third of the entire U.S. Supreme Court that has taken it upon itself the right to overturn acts of the legislature will have been appointed by an individual who got fewer votes than his opponent. There is no other democratic system on the planet that would recognize that as a means by which we represent majority interests. Regarding the notorious ACB, I mean, it's vulgar, it's awful, it's contemptuous, it's the Trump administration, it's totally on brand. What I do think is more important is that, first of all, it reveals the sophisticated way in which they think about gender, right? It's like, well, she was a woman, we'll get another woman and that'll be fine, right? And helping us all learn that, of course, you can be anti-feminist and a woman too, just as the mere fact that you are a man doesn't make you anti-feminist. But I think that more important, right, instead of us having that conversation, I would rather us have a conversation nationally about, say, the forced sterilization of women in our concentration camps, right? If we're going to talk about gender and policy and politics, I would rather talk about the real crimes against humanity that we are, in fact, committing as we speak.
So as we're talking about what should happen during the confirmation hearing, we're talking about sort of the contempt that they are showing by, you know, embracing Ruth Bader Ginsburg's image and then applying it, Dean Sviliotis, to Amy. I keep thinking about some of the other issues about what could Biden do. And there was an article, I think it was in Time magazine, and it was written by a guy, I think, that writes for The Nation, but it was in Time. And he said that what Biden should do is do a let's make a deal with Mitch McConnell and say to Mitch McConnell, look, delay this vote. And if you delay the vote, I promise you that if I get elected, I won't expand the court. That I'm going to do a let's make a deal. All these things that they're talking about that they're going to do is revenge. I will promise you I won't do. Don't do this until we get the decision from the election. And someone called me up and said, what do you think of that idea? And so, Dean, what I said is that he'll never go along with it. And the reason he'll never go along with it is that there is no way in heck that Donald Trump will allow anyone to suggest he might lose. And to make a deal with Joe Biden is to imply that for some reason, Biden might win and Trump might lose. So they are like, the Republicans are castrated. They can't do anything except Trump's bidding. Even if they know he's going to lose, they still need to follow his lead. Even if they are worried about their own election, they still need to follow his lead because he delivers the base. And if they have somehow antagonized him, they lose. I've never seen a situation where the GOP is in such a vice.
Yeah, the concept of public trust or any kind of trust between political actors, what political scientists sometimes call institutional reciprocity, it's been so damaged, so fundamentally damaged, that you know there aren't really even deals to be made that people will believe in anymore. I just don't think there's that trust just isn't, it doesn't exist anymore. There's been too much backstabbing for anybody to take that kind of a deal. And McConnell's going to go through with this. They're willing to shoulder the obvious hypocrisy of making a different argument not too long ago to get the thing. You know, if Trump wins, in their mind, it's fine. He'll get his appointment. If Trump loses, or maybe the Senate goes Democratic, well, then this is their last chance. So no matter how you slice it, I think it's very likely to happen. There's no incentive for McConnell to make any deals with Joe Biden that I can see. It would be almost refreshing to me at this point if everybody would stop the post hoc justifications and rationalizations for behavior. You know, well, in these circumstances, you go forward. In those circumstances, you don't go forward. We know the Constitution says president nominates, Senate votes to advise and votes to confirm. Obama should have gotten a vote. Judge Barrett's going to get a vote. All this other stuff about when you do and don't go forward. Yeah, lots of hypocrisy flying around. But in the end, in terms of the Constitution, it just doesn't mean all that much. And it's getting to be kind of tiresome at this point. There's just, you know, every time I see someone on TV explaining to me why it's okay this time, but it wasn't last time, I just say, you know, just why bother, right? McConnell's just going to kind of go with it. People will judge for themselves whether they're willing to tolerate the hypocrisy when they vote in November. So I don't see any deals being made. I don't even know, you know, who knows if Democrats will try to pack the court. This is one of these sort of ideas that bubbles up now and then. You know, I don't know if it's a liberal or a progressive revenge fantasy, but a number of Democratic senators have already said they're not in favor of that. But who knows at this point? You know, who knows at this point?
So Ken, answer this question for me. If you want to put a term limit on Supreme Court justices, 18 years, 24 years, whatever, is it just a matter of passing a law? I mean, is there any constitutional requirement that says they have to stay in perpetuity? Is there anything that says they get to sort of decide when they leave?
I think the Judiciary Act of 1792 89. As amended, 89. The first one that they enacted was not good enough, and so they enacted a second one
the following year.
But anyway, it establishes the Congress's right to set these sort of ground rules on how.
Yeah, it's statutory. It works. It's not the. Yeah,
it's statutory. So to me,
the only constitutional language is that they serve during good behavior and you cannot count their salaries while they are in office. Okay. But Congress can define good behavior, right? They can only be removed for good behavior during their 18-year term, right? I can see. Right. Enacting that legislatively.
What I was going to say, Arnie, though, is that I agree completely that we shouldn't talk about the rationale of the hypocrisy and all of that. I would go with the writers, and there are a fair number of them, who are saying, look, this is just pure political power. This is what politicians can do and do. Right. And they've got the power and they're doing it. And 4 years ago, they had the power and their rationalization was just nonsense, but it doesn't matter. They have the power.
Right.
They're exercising raw power and
why even get used to it? Why even bother? Why even bother with all the post hoc?
I agree with you. Rick. Here's my dilemma. Republicans actually they stick together like Velcro. They, you know, there is no such thing as a Republican that represents the poor. There's no such thing as a Republican that doesn't represent Wall Street. There isn't such a thing as a Republican that doesn't represent, you know, the private marketplace. The Democrats, however, we're more of a hodgepodge. Okay, you got the kind of Wall Street friendly Democrats, you got the environmental Democrats, you got the Bernie Sanders, more socialized Democrats. You've got this sort of interesting mix. You know, they call them new Dems, I believe. So you've got the Progressive Caucus. There is no new Republican. They're all kind of the same. So the problem then becomes, when Democrats get power, they are not effective at using that power. They end up gutting that. I mean, they begin to sort of negotiate with themselves before they even offer anything in the way of legislation. The Affordable Care Act was basically pre-gutted before it even went to Congress, because we decided, you know, what was it that we could give up before we even had to negotiate? And that's my fear. My fear is I see a lethal Republican Party that not only understands power, Rick, they use it. And then I see a Democratic Party that goes, oh, you know, power, it sounds so awful.
They wring their hands. But here's the I would like to stay focused on. In order to try to get them to use the power, the first thing we have to do is get the power.
Right.
And I agree with everything that was said, that, you know, forget the process. Trust me, when I have 42 years of being involved in politics, if I've learned anything at all, it is that the public doesn't care about process.
Right.
Arguments do not resonate with Joe Sixpack or Joe Bag of Donuts. It doesn't matter. And so we said earlier, the Democrats should focus, ask questions of her positions on issues that are relative to the ACA and other issues. It appears to me she's a qualified jurist. It appears to me she has integrity from what I've read about her. And though I disagree, I'm sure, with most everything she probably stands for, she's probably qualified to be on the Supreme Court. She's going to be on the Supreme Court.
Exactly, Rick.
So there is no point in getting into a process argument. We should be focused on the issues. But I agree with you, Arnie, the Democrats, Tip O'Neill was the last Democrat that could use power. O'Neill got Ronald Reagan, you know, they had a couple of drinks together, they played poker together, they passed legislation. They did things, they worked together to compromise. Ted Kennedy could do it with Ronald Reagan. We haven't seen that kind of bipartisan work, even an effort by the Democrats in the last 20 years. Maybe this whole episode, should they get power, we'll see something different. I certainly hope so.
Okay, so I have to touch on Breonna Taylor. I have to touch on what happened. I think they should remove the Kentucky Attorney General. I think he should be impeached. When I heard him come out, and there was one indictment, I believe, from the grand jury, am I right, Stephen? And it was for one of the cops. It had nothing to do with what happened to Breonna Taylor. It had to do with some cop outside who was shooting, who shouldn't have been doing it. And it turned out that the people that he was shooting at, that they were actually noticing, happened to be the white people living in the apartment house, not even the black people living upstairs above Breonna Taylor. I mean, the whole thing was just so racist. It was unbelievable. But what is even more shocking, this is unbelievable. Vice News just came out and we were told that none of the cops was wearing a body camera. Now, that just seemed kind of bizarre at a time where, you know, body cameras seem to be almost virtually everywhere. Well, it turned out, Stephen, that's a lie. One of the cops was wearing a body camera. So as we are looking, I mean, I feel like there is nothing even close to justice that comes out of Kentucky when it comes to Breonna Taylor. Nothing. Lies, covers up, a manipulation of the system. The Attorney General, he needs to reveal basically what was brought forward to the grand jury. He has to do it. And now that we find out that the lie about the body camera has now come out, and it turns out that one of the people who said he'd actually heard them knocking on the door has now recanted and said he didn't hear them knocking on the door when apparently they did, to notify the folks inside. I mean, this is a made-for-TV horror movie, and yet everything that spells the opposite of justice is now being sort of front and center with Breonna Taylor. And I think this story cannot disappear. It isn't just about Black Lives Matter. It's about the fact that justice doesn't exist. I mean, this kind of manipulation is unbelievable to me, Stephen.
But this story will, of course, disappear. We know that. The details change, right? But the story remains the same. And this is, you know, when you hear people using the language of defunding the police, which means different, like Medicare for all, right? It means different things to different people and plays out in different kinds of ways. But the fundamental critique underlying that is the recognition that these are systems that are so fundamentally corrupt to their very core that there is no reform that is available.
Yes, yes. That's what is so shocking and exhausting. I mean, the Kentucky.
Shocked by, right. These are institutions that were born of white supremacy and regulating marginalized populations in order to maintain racial and economic hierarchy. And that is the ways in which they continue to function and have functioned throughout all of our damn history. How can we still be surprised when we see yet another Black American killed by agents of the state? How does that still surprise us?
But you know what, I get the sense, Dean, it's so I'm thinking about the Amy Coney Barrett, and everyone's gonna say, oh, well, it's a woman. Donald Trump is trying to appeal to women because his poll numbers with women are just trash. I mean, I think that Biden has a 30% approval rating over Donald Trump with women. And so I think in Trump's head, well, all women are the same. I'm gonna get credit because I'm appointing Amy Coney Barrett. Well, that's why, I know you don't like the term infomercial, but that's one of the reasons why the consequence of Amy is so anti-female that, guess what? In a lot of ways, it's gonna bring more women, I think, into the voting booth. When you look at what happened with the Black Attorney General in Kentucky, and when you realize the kind of cover-up and the manipulation of justice that occurred, just because he's a Black Attorney General isn't gonna give him a pass. In some ways, it makes it even more of a horror story when it comes to the lack of justice and how willing people are to manipulate it. In a bizarre way, the Republicans thought, look what we've done. I've got a Black AG, look what we've done. I've got a white, I've got a woman going on the bench. And in a lot of ways, it almost heightens and incenses people even more, Dean.
Well, it shows a lack of understanding of the underlying dynamics. It's a very superficial notion of, you know, demographic or constituency-based politics. It's the same logic driving the ACB t-shirts that well, you know, they had one, so we can have one too. We just have to have a t-shirt with a picture on it. And it certainly the case with women, Trump does not really understand why there's a record gender gap of around 20 points, I think, at this point, which is remarkable. It might even be higher, but it's a remarkable gap. It shows a lack of understanding of why women are fleeing him as a candidate. And there's not anything in particular about this nomination that's going to bring any of those women back. It'll maybe settle down some of the more restive evangelicals who are already in his base, but that's really about it.
So Ken, let me just read the headline from Vice so people understand. This story just came out. New body cam footage raises questions about Breonna Taylor's death investigation. Footage and documents obtained by Vice News depict Louisville police officers apparently violating department policies and cast doubt on the integrity of the crime scene and the investigation. This is just unbelievable. And that the Attorney General did not know about these body cameras, that he did not know. I mean, in a bizarre way, because Breonna Taylor is a female. Amy Coney Barrett is a female. These two stories, if they think that somehow all females think alike, these two stories about women are going to, I think, even enrage women even more.
Well, absolutely, and especially the way the administration is presenting it, which is as if, as you just described, we're appointing a woman, so all women voters should give us praise and vote for us because we're pro-woman. Well, all women aren't fungible. They're not like slicing and dicing. They're all the same thing. And let me give you one example just to remind you, Clarence Thomas, this is the same thing. We're going to appoint a Black man to the Supreme Court to replace Thurgood Marshall, for crying out loud. And, you know, just because he's a Black man, we're okay with the Black community because it doesn't really matter whether it has any policies, any legal analysis that is consistent with the needs of the African-American community. And this is the same with Amy Coney Barrett. And I just want to say one thing about the cops with the body cams. I thought I had read that there were body cams actually in the cruiser, or they were wearing them and they weren't turned on. But there are so many instances, Arnie, of police who are involved in all of these incidents harming Black people. And they have body cams, but they don't turn them on. So, yeah, we really care about transparency. And so we're going to buy all of these body cams. We're just not going to use them so nobody can see the bad things that we do.
Well, once again, we think technology, Rick, is going to save us. You know, but if you don't turn the technology on, it ain't going to save us. If there's too much technology, then no one can figure it out. I mean, in a lot of ways, technology is a way to become more obtuse. It makes it even harder. I mean, look at the technology of Facebook. What has it done? You know, it spread lies now instantaneously. And if you want to know how to pollute the political system, take a look at Twitter and take a look at Facebook. But Rick, before we go, I just have to talk about this because I saw this story also at the Hill Reporter. Kyle Rittenhouse's mother, okay? Now let's remind everyone who Kyle Rittenhouse is. He's the young 17-year-old who came armed up to Wisconsin, to Kenosha.
White 17-year-old.
Right. And he killed two folks and I think wounded some other people and was allowed to go home and then eventually got arrested, you know, because of the fact that now he is, you know, accused of murder. But listen to this. Kyle Rittenhouse's mother joins GOP women's event while son awaits trial. Kyle's mother gets a standing ovation, Rick.
It's beyond, that's just beyond understanding, but I've got a comment on the Breonna Taylor case. Here's the thing. Forget about everything that body cams and everything else. There was a couple in bed in their home in total knowledge that neither of them had committed any crime whatsoever. Whether the police yelled police or didn't, whether they knocked or didn't, is irrelevant. Someone busted through their door with a gun in their hand. And if you did that in my house, I'm gonna shoot you because I'm there knowing that I have committed no crime. So somebody is guilty at a minimum of the negligent homicide of this woman, whether it was the person who signed the warrant or the cop who gave bad information to get the warrant or the cop who fired the gun, but somebody is guilty of negligent homicide at a bare minimum.
But so, Dean, this is the part that makes me crazy, that Kyle Rittenhouse's mother gets a standing ovation at a GOP women's event. What's right and what's wrong anymore? I don't know. I'm looking at these people and I keep thinking, what has Donald Trump, has he done this to you? Has he drained you of your ability to sort of exercise independent judgment? Has he taken away the sense of integrity? Is there no sense of outrage? Is there something right about murder that I don't know about in this context? I mean, this story, I mean, in a lot of ways just hit me in the stomach. Because it's beyond appalling. And I keep trying to figure out what has Donald Trump done to the GOP base, or what has the GOP done to create a base that is so willing to sort of follow this kind of lead in such an unquestioning and cultish way.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about this before. This is like identity politics. It's almost like a tribal politics. We've been moving in this direction for some time now. It's driven by social media. It's different parties living in different information ecosystems in which there are competing, prevailing narratives and fitting the various day-to-day events into those larger narratives. You know, I can't remember the exact slogan, but I saw on the web some t-shirts that had the young man's image on it and something like guardian angel or some other kind of right-wing slogan, you know, implying that he was a savior. And that's just where we are at this point. Trump has certainly made it much worse. He's taken it to a level that we've never been at before, but shades of this really go back, you know, even as far back as, as Sarah Palin and even a little earlier, you start to get this kind of queasy feeling that we're not all looking at the same reality anymore, and we're not drawing our information from, you know, the same news sources, et cetera. And this is all going to get rolled into the next election and how we interpret who wins and the competing narratives about whether or not who rigged it and who didn't, all that kind of stuff.
So I tweeted something out yesterday, and I want to sort of end with this tweet. 2016, we went from Obama to Trump. 2020, we're going from Ginsburg to Coney Barrett. Here's my question. Can a nation drowning in illness and death survive such political blows? I mean, when you look at the swings at the highest office of the land, when you look at the swings on the Supreme Court, and then you put it into this horrific pot of pandemics and climate change and Black Lives Matter, I am frightened in a way I've never been frightened before. I will fight like I've never fought before. But I can't imagine a debate on Tuesday night with someone who will lie about everything and someone who's going to try to focus on policy, something not only does Donald Trump not respect, but policy is something he's willing to manipulate for any kind of outcome that will serve him. It is going to be such a challenge, this debate on Tuesday night. I can't wait for our Rethink the Week next week. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for joining us. Rick Newman, thank you. Stephen Pimper, Dean Spiliotis, I thank you all. And of course, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes, my producer. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.
I'm warning you people. Be careful how you go. Yes, I'm warning you people. Be careful how you go. Be so careful. But when you go to that voting booth, love is sure they don't cut your throat. The alderman say one thing, the president say the same. They about know how much money you got, can you play that game? Now I'm warning you people, please be careful how you vote. Yeah, the one they say gonna do something for you, they will know if you got the vote. Can you vote for them? Have a good time, man. I'm warning you. Be careful how you vote. The ones say they're gonna do so much for you. Now they don't want to touch your phone. I tell you how I feel. Money. Love your life, never change.